It's 9 minutes past seven now. Time for It Says in the Papers with Caroline Murphy.
Adams says abuse victims failed by IRA actions. That's the headline in the Irish Times today. We're told Gerry Adams said last night abuse victims were failed by the IRA policy of shooting alleged sex offenders, and that his admission came as Enda Kenny and Peter Robinson prepare to meet Maria Cahill. Picking up on what Mr. Robbins posted last night on his blog, the paper reports him saying IRA members were singularly ill-equipped to deal with such matters. Matters to do with a former senior IRA member meanwhile make the front of the Irish Daily Mirror. That paper leads with a claim which it says is being made about the late Joe Cahill, former chief of staff of the organisation, that pictures of him were used to blackmail him into spying for authorities. The authority of the IRA itself, meanwhile, is the subject of a piece on page 2 in the Times. Writing about Maria Cahill while also recalling the heroic sisters of the murdered Robert McCartney, Mary Minahan says, "It wouldn't be the first time republicanism has been derailed by mistreated women." But from women to water, the other story to dominate today is of Irish water and its bonus structure. It makes the front of the Times alongside the Adams story, but it's the lead for many of the others. Irish Water's €9,000 bonus for staff who need improvement is how the Irish Independent headline puts it. Bonuses for water staff lambasted is the headline in the Irish Examiner, while outrage as Irish Water pays bonus for failure is the one in the Irish Daily Mail. In The Independent, John Downing writes that the mood within both Fine Gael and Labour is increasingly angry, as TDs believe serious public relations disasters at Irish Water could cost them the next election. In The Mail, Niamh Lyons says the government is coming under massive pressure to find a way to cancel the bonus payments in the forthcoming finance bill. While in The Examiner, Sean Connolly says Fianna Fáil have accused the government of trying to scapegoat Irish Water's John Tierney. Irish Rugby's Brian O'Driscoll gets a lot of attention meanwhile this morning. Following the publication of extracts from his autobiography, the Irish Sun picks up on his experience of the American justice system. "Bod my terror in hellhole jail" is the headline there, while The Independent puts his picture on page one and follows up with a spread over pages 2 and 3, looking at how he described his dark days and the death of his friend Barry Toomey. On the evidence of yesterday's extract, says Vincent Hogan, O'Driscoll understood the need to peel back a few layers of the public persona and reveal some of what lies beneath. Otherwise, this morning, the Irish Daily Star leads with that very sad death of a teenage boxer in Cork after a chip pan fire, while the picture on the front of the Times marks the memorial service for Ian Paisley. And in features, the Examiner has a special report on the new policing authority. The rush to establish it has left important questions about how it will work go unanswered, says Cormac O'Keefe. While in the Times, Conor Pope looks at what he says has been a shaky first year for the insolvency service. But finally, from insolvency to cash splash, the Independent says spending on weddings is up. A third of couples, we're told, are spending 20 grand on their big day. The big fat wedding, says Gillian Fitzpatrick, is back.
Caroline, thank you. It's almost 13 minutes past seven and Brian Finn's here with our first look at the business news. Morning, Brian.
Thank you, Rachel. Good morning. Asian markets bounced back overnight following the lead from the US, where markets staged an impressive comeback late on Friday. That in response to some good economic data stateside. However, the volatility seen in the last week or so may not be over yet. Chinese GDP figures are due out in the coming days. The government there has been penciling in third quarter growth of 7.7%. But it's expected that it could come in as low as 7.2%, which could send markets back into a tailspin. It's also third quarter earnings season in the US, with some big names reporting this week. Apple will outline its performance for the 3 months from July to the end of September tonight. It's expected to report a fairly decent outcome, with analysts looking at a 12% increase in iPhone sales, but an 8% fall in iPad sales. The outlook for the all-important holiday season is expected to be good. It's also anticipated that Apple will launch its e-payment system in the US with partners including Chase and Citibank. The Wall Street Journal has been reporting that a consortium of investors from Hong Kong and Abu Dhabi are lining up to buy sports goods maker Reebok from Adidas. It's reported that they will offer in excess of $2 billion for the company, which Adidas acquired 8 years ago for $3.8 billion. Jinwell Capital and its partners argue that Reebok would fare better as an independent company. There was a 40% increase in building project commencements in the first eight months of the year compared to the same period last year. That's according to the National Construction Index compiled by the group Link to Plans. Planning applications were up 12%. The group compiles the data from real-time planning and project information in each of the local authority areas. Most of the gains, however, were front-loaded towards the start of the year. And we'll be hearing from Danny O'Shea of Link to Plans in the later bulletin. But for now, on the currencies, the euro is trading at $1.27.5 and 79.2 pence sterling, Rachel.
Thank you, Brian. It's 7:15 and you're with Morning Ireland. The latest revelations about Irish water continue to reverberate this morning. Yesterday, RTE reported details of the company's bonus scheme, under which staff can receive substantial additional payments even if their performance is deemed to need improvement. Senior management, whose work far exceeds expectations, are entitled to a 19% salary top-up. And of course, the newly formed company was already under fire over its communications with the public. Our political correspondent, Martina Fitzgerald, is here. Martina, Fianna Fáil's Barry Cowan called Irish Water a gold-plated, bonus-driven super quango. But what's the government saying?
Well, first of all, bonuses are back in the headlines practically on every newspaper front page today, and with good reason following John Burke's revelations yesterday. Basically, we knew back in January that there was a bonus scheme in place at Irish Water. That came out at an Oireachtas committee. And Fergus O'Dowd, who was the minister who had steered the legislation through the Oireachtas at the time, said that's when he first learned about it. And many ministers said similar comments. But in a PQ at that time, it's really interesting, we found out that performance-related payments at Irish Water would range from between 2.75 to 15%. That was in a PQ from the Department of Environment to Kevin Humphreys, and that 100 staff could earn between 14 and 15% in bonuses at that stage. Now, 9 months later, this issue is resurrected, and basically John Burke found out that senior staff at Irish Water and his parent company Arvia can earn bonuses up to 19% if they far exceed expectations. And for most people, the most interesting element of what he revealed yesterday is that performance related awards are not limited to just those who meet or exceed targets, but there are also include staff who get an official need improvement rating. So 9 months on, drip, 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 and we're still back to bonuses, and this is going to unnerve government backbenchers, government ministers, and they already had plenty of reasons to be unnerved in the first place.
But what can they do about it? Richard Bruton was also on This Week yesterday, and he seemed to say that there was actually little that the government could do.
Well, there will be contractual obligations on behalf of the company. And if you remember back at that time, at first it came to light, there was a statement from the Department of Communications saying that they had, this was part of a negotiation with staff between Bord Gáis, and that it had driven down in Bord Gáis costs of 34 million over 4 years, and there was a pay freeze, there was abolished increment, they had abolished increments, and so there was a lot of elements to this. Now, the company also has made the point very stridently that this is not a traditional bonus scheme, that it is an at-risk part of your salary, and that you have to earn it based on your performance and based on your unit's performance and based on the company's performance. But bonuses are politically toxic, as everyone knows, even the word. That's why we're calling them pay-related performance or performance-related payments even.
Even though if the entire board and every senior manager left Irish Water, because there has been this talk in the papers over the weekend about the government maybe wanting some members of the board to go, maybe up to and including the boss, these same structures would still be in place and the public would still have to pay water charges.
Well, there are very serious soundings coming from senior levels in government about Irish water. And the Sunday Independent and the Sunday Business Post had reports yesterday about an overhaul. The Sunday Independent suggesting that the parent company and Irish Water, the boards would merge into one. But also comments from John Tierney saying that there was no truth in suggesting that he would be leaving. But at the end of the day, after the Fine Gael parliamentary meeting last Wednesday, and let's just remind ourselves, Irish Water wasn't raised at the parliamentary party meeting. It was the topic. That's the day after the budget, which is interesting in itself. But many TDs saying that they were being told by senior personnel in the party that there were serious scrutiny now going to be placed on Irish Water at the highest levels.
So what does that mean then? Where does this go from here?
Well, obviously it's going to dominate again the political agenda this week because it has replaced health since the Dáil returned after the summer break. I mean, 2 days last week, Wednesday and Thursday, really you just couldn't keep up with the number of water-related stories. You had the Fine Gael, you had the Labour parliamentary meetings, you had this issue of how people were going to benefit who are not eligible for a tax relief or the social welfare payment. You had Desi Ellis raising this issue of tenants in Wicklow County Council. You had Alan Kelly telling the News at One and the Labour parliamentary party meeting on Wednesday that he had raised concerns about bonuses. The next day you had bonuses, you had Meath County Council development issuing similar letters, and you had this deadline for returning your packets. That's just 2 days. The government are dealing with issues and Irish Water on several fronts over a 48-hour period. It was extraordinary. Now, one thing I think everyone will agree that within the government, they will not want to see this drag on. There's a long lead-in to those, to people start paying. There's an awfully long lead-in to the election.
It's worth remembering that we haven't actually got the bills as yet. When the bills do start arriving in January, you can imagine that there's going to be a lot more talk then.
And government backbenchers in particular don't want to see a repeat of what happened earlier in this year, where you had literally months of justice-related issues. They want some finality, of these issues addressed, and they don't want to be dealing with bonuses in January and bonuses in October.
Martina, thank you very much for that. Gardaí are warning of traffic disruption at Dublin Port this morning because of a protest by hauliers. Trucks are being prevented from exiting Dublin Port and the Eastlink toll bridge roundabout is blocked. Owen Gavin, the president of the Irish Road Haulage Association, is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning.
How many of you are there at the moment?
There's over 150 haulage people, representatives from the Irish Road Haulage Association or National Council, following a meeting on Saturday night, born out of frustration, really, that the government have failed to tackle the problem of the current cost of taxing a heavy goods vehicle in Southern Ireland as opposed to the UK. It's €4,000 to tax a heavy goods vehicle in Dublin, £640 in Newry. And on top of that, the UK government last April introduced a £10 levy on all foreign vehicles within mainland UK and Northern Ireland. It's 50,000 jobs are represented here this morning. That's what the Irish road haulage industry represents to this economy. We've carried the goods of the Irish export-led economy over the last 6 years. We've been very proactive in our approach to lobbying. We've been shown in front of Oireachtas finance committees, transport committees. We've met with EDs, ministers, but very disappointed with the response and no response in the budget last week. Road tax needs to be tackled. Okay. There needs to be a provision made in the Finance Act.
All right. And people may have sympathy with your argument. What they're unlikely to have sympathy with, though, is what you're doing this morning. Rather than disrupting Dublin on a Monday morning, could you not just continue those talks with the government?
Well, the National Council met on Saturday evening. They felt that the Haulage Association was kind of left in limbo land last week. They felt there was no other option. 90% of the vehicles inside the port gates this morning are owned by the business people that are standing at the gates. 50,000 people across this island are relying on those trucks for their job this morning. They're all behind us as well.
And do you have any reason to believe, though, that this particular course of action will work?
Well, it's the artery. It's the artery of the country is Dublin Port. We're the blood that flows through it. We cannot have a situation where there's 2,000 trucks currently re-registered out of the south of Ireland to Bulgaria, to Poland, to Northern Ireland and mainland UK. What the haulage industry are saying, why should we leave our towns and villages where we operate our trucks for over half a century and more and emigrate out of this island? People are standing up for their living.
How long are you likely to stay there this morning?
I'm sure after 9 or 10 o'clock this morning, the traffic will try and move again. We've had good support from the Dublin Port Authority, good support from the Garda Síochána. All of these people, the Road Safety Authority, Department of Transport, rely on Irish registered trucks. Not UK registered trucks, not Polish registered trucks. Irish registered trucks bring direct taxation into this economy. They need to be looked after. There needs to be a differential. The differential needs to be removed. €4,000 to tax an articulated truck in Dublin, £640 in Newry. That's unsustainable.
Yeah, as we've been saying, there is quite a difference there. But in terms of your talks with the government, who have you been talking to and where do those discussions stand at the moment?
This time, 12 months ago, we were redirected to the Department of Environment. We sat down with Till Hogan twice on it. He redirected us to the Department of Transport. Leo Varadkar, in his mission statement last January, said that one of his plans was to restructure road tax. Nothing has been done. 2nd of September, we sat with the new minister, Pascal Donoghue. Pascal indicated, yes, the Department of Transport is looking at a report and they are behind it. They realise there is a problem. And he said, in terms, it is a finance issue. We pay the money that we tax our vehicles into the Department of Finance's kitty. Department of Environment administrated through the local county council offices. Department of Transport issued the tax books and registered vehicles in this country. Those three departments need to sit down with the industry and need to come up with a structure similar to the UK and similar to the other countries in Europe. It's not rocket science. The structures are there. The road tax legislation for our vehicles is going back to 1956. In this modern era of 2014, you know, we cannot operate under 1956 legislation.
All right, Owen Gavin, President of the Irish Road Haulage Association, thank you for talking to us.
Despite the high standards and decency of the vast majority of IRA volunteers, IRA personnel were singularly ill-equipped to deal with these matters. This included very sensitive areas such as responding to demands to take action against rapists and child abusers. The IRA on occasion shot alleged sex offenders or expelled them. While this may have been expedient at the time, it was not appropriate. But these actions were of their time and reflected not only a community at war, but also an attitude within Ireland which did not then understand or know as we now do how deeply embedded abuse is in our society. That's what Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams said last night in a statement in response to allegations from Belfast woman Maria Cahill that she was interrogated by the IRA in the late 1990s over her claim that she was raped by a member of the IRA and that the IRA covered it up. We'll be talking to Sinn Féin TD Desi Ellis later in the programme, but let's speak now to the former leader of the SDLP, now MP for Foyle, Mark Durkan. Mark Durkan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Gavin.
What do you make of this statement?
Well, Gerry Adams has, I suppose, finally moved to admit more about what the provisional movement did in relation to abuse and what they failed to do. The fact is that whenever the Spotlight programme came on, Sinn Féin went into a position of denial in relation to the specific issues that Maria Cahill raised, and also they were in denial about the wider issues and the possible patterns that were suggested, not just by Maria but others in the wake of the Spotlight programme. They have spent days trying to viciously attack a victim. All sorts of people seem to have emerged to push what seemed to be the official party line, that there was nothing to see here, move on, nothing to hear about. Would people stop listening to this woman and just listen to us? The fact is, Gerry Adams has obviously felt moved and pushed to now admit more than he and others from Sinn Féin were doing in the first few days. But the his statement yesterday or his blog is still somewhat elliptical. It's still evasive in relation to the core points raised by Maria Cahill.
Several members of Sinn Féin, including Gerry Adams, have been at pains to stress in recent days that they believe Maria Cahill when she says that she was raped and abused, but they have contended with her allegation that there was an IRA investigation and a cover-up. This statement seems to go some way towards that now, doesn't it?
Yes, well, I don't even think they were as generous or forthcoming as you suggest that they were in relation to some of Maria's story, and you only have to look at what some people who are at other times relied upon by the leadership as friendly commentators have been saying about Maria Cahill and some of her specific allegations. But the fact is that, yes, Gerry Adams' statement has moved from the sort of things where he'd said, if there was an investigation by the IRA, then that would have been wrong. He seems now to be accepting that there were, but he should be more categoric about that, and he should have more grace in saying that if there was any ambiguity about what he had said in the last few days, he absolutely wants to nail that now. And remember, there weren't just these investigations, it was then also the outcomes where victims were re-traumatised. I mean, his statement seems to be talking about as though, yes, the IRA had to act, or because of the circumstances, the IRA acted sometimes by shooting, sometimes by expelling people. He makes it sound as though the IRA were directly acting against abuse, whereas in a number of cases, what they were doing, just as we know with the church and other institutions, did. Abuse was being covered up in a way that was aimed at protecting the institution rather than actually trying to meet the offence and deal with it in an active or effective way that prevented other victims. So there is still, you know, a disingenuous dimension to what Gerry Adams is saying in his latest blog or statement, but it does move away from some of the super pretense of the last few days, but it is still not fully acknowledging what needs to be acknowledged and understood. And I say that not as a political point, but just to ensure that any of us, when we hear about aspects of abuse in the past and how it was dealt with, there can simply be no pretense or no evasion.
It's 7:30. I'll get to the news headlines in just a moment. We heard in, it says in the papers earlier, the front page of the Daily Mirror this morning claiming that Joe Cahill, a senior member of the IRA and also a relative of Maria Cahill, was in fact a British double agent. What do you make of this story, and what do you make of the timing of this story?
Well, the timing of the story is perhaps because Joe Cahill's name is in out there in the media. Or whatever. I have no idea about any basis for that story. And, you know, just because somebody in the media has put that out there, I'm not going to immediately give that credence. I do, however, believe Maria Cahill. Maria Cahill is someone whom I met quite a number of times because she spent a few years as a constituent of mine. And I had heard her story and knew her story, had heard it in confidence and wasn't able to say or do that much about it, in the sense that I couldn't do anything that would have been seen to interfere with the investigations and the due process that was supposedly underway. So there's a difference between responding to a story that just happens to be on the front page of the papers, for which I know no basis.
Mark Durkin, SDLP MP for Foyle. Thank you very much for speaking to us this morning. 7:38, you're listening to Morning Ireland, and Darren Frettl is here with all the sports news. Morning, Darren.
Good morning, Gavin. A very busy weekend. We'll start with the rugby. Leinster made a winning start at the Champions Cup. They had a 25-20 win against Wasps. The Irish province were 12 down at one stage in the first half, but they fought back for a 5-point victory. Dara Fanning scored two tries, while Dominic Ryan touched down for the third. Ian Madigan kicked two penalties and two conversions. Michael Corcoran's been speaking to the Leinster skipper and man of the match, Jamie Heaslip.
I thought we were a bit loose at times with the ball, and we've got to look at that, you know, because at this level, I mean, you just won't get away with that. Yeah. We were quite lucky today to get away with it. There's one or two other turnovers that they could have ran the nearly ran the length of the field as well, and that would have been a very different game. You know, we really punished ourselves, making ourselves chase that game in the second half. But again, I can't take away from the passion or the intensity to just roll up their sleeves and carry hard and get through a lot of work, a lot of unseen work by players out there, a lot of stuff that, you know, that people don't really take hold of or really notice, like really good carries, really good rucking, clean and deep, you know, even simple like chopping guys and back ending that tackle, you know, stuff that goes unnoticed. That's the stuff we kind of build ourselves on, those basics.
And just a final question, a quick word about Castro next week.
We went over there last year, gave them a 14-point head start in the first 20 minutes, you know, and we can't do that against these kind of sides. We learned our lesson a couple of weeks ago by giving a side that had a head start, and this week we did it again, and just from basic errors, and we got to work on that, you know. But a very, you know, unbelievably tough with the outcome and the intensity and the mindset of lads, you know. Worked hard early in the week to get all the detail in, and it was all about just getting your head right for just seeing how far you can push it.
More on the rugby in the next hour here on Morning Ireland. Liverpool are up to fifth in the Premier League standings after a 3-2 win away to QPR. Remarkable game this one. And Richard Dunn handed Liverpool the lead in the 67th minute with his 10th own goal of his career. An unwanted record there for Richard. The other four goals came in a dramatic final 8 minutes. A second own goal deep in injury time by Stephen Corker sealed the win for the visitors. And Liverpool manager Brendan Rodgers, very honest after the game. He felt his side were lucky to win.
We were very, very lucky, you know, to get the win. We showed tremendous character and were a little bit better in the second half. But no, the QPR definitely deserves something from the game. First half, we didn't pass the ball. We had no rhythm in our game. Movement was too slow. Touches, slow. No speed in the game. Joe Allen and Young Coutinho coming on gives us that real technical lift in the game. And obviously then we started to create that wee bit more. I thought Raheem Sterling was outstanding today in his running and his desire to go in and where I heard he was really quick thinking on the first goal and obviously he's breaking away on the other one. So, but now overall we were fortunate, but everyone knows it takes, you know, it's a long season, you're going to not play well in games and you hope to get points, and today we get 3 points, but QPR were very unfortunate.
Elsewhere, Jonathan Walters' goal in the 76th minute gives Stoke a 2-1 win against Swansea. Now, it was a very busy weekend in Gaelic games on the club front in football. A late goal from Desi Moen saw Monaghan's Clontibert beat Kilcoo of Down 1-9 to 11 points in the Ulster Football Championship. Cora Finn and Cross McGlenn defended their county championship crowns in Galway and Armagh. Shlock Neal beat Ballinderry in the Derry Football Final. St Gall's are the Antrim champions again. St Bridget's meted 5 Roscommon titles in a row. In Meath, Navan O'Mahony's overcame Dunamore Ashburn by 2 points. Ballincollig won their first ever Cork title thanks to a 113 to 110 victory against Carnby Rangers. In Kildare, Sarsfields and Moorfield will meet again after their match ended in a draw. Portlaoise are the league champions for the 8th successive season, while the Nair saw of Stradbally in Waterford. Ballintubber overcame Castlebar Mitchells by a goal in the Mayo decider. Killian O'Connor kicked 1-3 for the winners.
It was tit for tat there. I think they probably started the better team in the first five, and I think our 2 goals came against run of play, but it's settled us. And in the county final, you won't get too many goal chances, so it was important we took them, and that gave us a platform then to push on.
Now, you're in the international rules squad, so you're going to be playing the Connacht Championship in a couple of weeks' time. What happens for you then?
I don't know. We're going to put the focus on the club. This is definitely the priority, to push on and maybe get further in Connacht than we did before, and this is a priority for now. So we'll sit down with the management tomorrow and we'll make plans.
Mike McCartney speaking to Killian O'Connor there. In hurling, Shelmaliers and St Anne's played out a draw in the Wexford decider. Kilcormac Colaghi met it 3 in a row in Offaly. Kilmallock pulled off a surprise victory in the Limerick final against Na Piersaigh. They're managed by a Clare man, Gerald Loughlin.
The one thing that I've been trying to instill into them is that you'll get nothing soft. And last year I came down as a neutral to watch them play Na Piersaigh in the semi-final, and they went very tamely out of the championship. And I've been trying to instill that into them, that if you do that, you're not going to win championships year in, year out. So their inconsistency had to be addressed. And I think, to be fair to them, it was brought out today, like in you know, they are the great characters, so it's a case of bringing it out and not letting them go back into a shell and things like that. So I'm glad collectively we did that anyway.
Well, the Sparrow, he's quite a name down in Limerick now. He's already won titles with Adair, now Kilmallock, so a great victory for them yesterday. Raharney are the Westmeath champions. St Mullins, the county champions in Carlow in their centenary year, while the Limerick title went to St Mary's. Kevin Phelan finished third place at the Hong Kong Open. He carded a final round of 66 to end the event on 11 under par, 2 behind Angelo Quay and eventual winner Scott Hend. Mikko Ilinen beat Henrik Stenson 3-1 to win the World Matchplay Championship in Kent.
Thank you very much, Darren. Nigeria's military says it has agreed a ceasefire with Islamist militants Boko Haram and that the schoolgirls the group has abducted will be released. Boko Haram sparked global outrage 6 months ago by abducting more than 200 girls. Journalist Chika Adua joins us now on the line from Nigeria. News of a possible deal to secure the girls' release first emerged on Friday. What's been happening since then?
You know what, since Friday we haven't heard much at all from any official government authorities, but we do know that some of the Nigerian government authorities have been talking to international media, and what they were telling the international media was that the details of the negotiation process, that is still going to be finalized. We heard that talks will continue in Chad this week, especially as it refers to bringing back the kidnapped girl.
What's known about what has become of these girls?
We heard that some of the girls have been dispersed throughout the West Africa region. Understandably, on a practical level, having 219 girls in one place, they would probably become a burden on Boko Haram, because I think a lot of Nigerians initially thought that these girls could be held in Sambisa Forest, but now we're hearing reports that perhaps Boko Haram has kind of separated these girls across West Africa to make it easier for them to manage. Again, we did hear reports that some of the girls were sold into slavery, but many people doubt this, and also just more news that they might have been performing maybe sexual favors for the Boko Haram fighters. But what we have an idea that they're not in one spot as initially thought.
It is a terribly sad and disturbing story. The military also talking, as I was saying at the weekend, about a ceasefire being agreed with Boko Haram. Has there been any evidence of that?
There has been absolutely no evidence of the ceasefire. You know, they're saying that they're talking to a Boko Haram spokesperson named Danladi Ahmad, but no one seems to know who this person is. And a lot of people say that he's not part of the Boko Haram leadership. So again, who is this person that they're allegedly negotiating with? And we do know that the president of Chad, Mr. Idris Derby, he has been a part of these talks about the ceasefire. And also we heard that one government official told international media that so far the ceasefire means that Boko Haram will not attack civilians, and Nigerian troops have been ordered not to shoot at Boko Haram strongholds. However, we did hear reports of attacks happening over the weekend. I personally have an informant in northern Nigeria who is a vigilante fighter, and he informed me that attacks did take place over the weekend, even after the supposed ceasefire. So right now, there's a lot of conflicting information, and the government is not really giving us anything clear or tangible to prove that the ceasefire truce is actually happening.
Well, listen, thank you very much indeed for joining us to bring us up to date. We'll be following developments. That was Chika Odua on the line there from Nigeria, with the time at 13 minutes to 8.
A tale reminiscent of the Cold War now. The Russian Defence Ministry has denied reports that one of its submarines got into trouble in the waters off Sweden. The Swedish military has been searching the area since Friday, following what the military said was foreign underwater activity. Soviet submarine sightings during the Cold War caused several security alerts in Sweden in the 1980s. Colm O'Callaghan is a journalist based in Sweden. We can talk to him now. Good morning, Colm.
Good morning.
What's going on here? What happened?
Well, what happened was actually a Swedish newspaper on Thursday managed to get information from the Swedish defence, where they seem to have intercepted some sort of message coming from the Swedish archipelago, and it was in Russian, is what we had understood. The Swedish Defence Department has said that that's not the case, but a day later another message seemed to have come through. This one was encrypted, and they could trace that it was coming from the archipelago over to Kaliningrad in Russia. So the expectation is that if there is underwater activity going on, it's probably from Russia, although the Swedish Defence Department and the Swedish Minister for Defence say we just believe that there is some underwater activity, but they're not saying which nation it's necessarily coming from.
Do the Russians, or have the Russians ever acknowledged that they have submarines or that they're active in this area?
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly active in the Baltic Sea, but they would never admit that they'd be active within Swedish territory. So that's the difference, if you like. So they have certainly been ramping up activity in the Baltic Sea and in that area, but not to anyone's knowledge have they been in Swedish territory. And as you mentioned in your introduction there, in the 1980s, they were in Swedish territory a lot, and a U-boat went aground in 1981 outside off the coast of Sweden, and that caused a huge stir. It was an international story at the time. And since then, there's really been a great concern, you know, on the Swedish side, that the Russians are interested in coming into Swedish waters and Swedish territories.
Why would the Russians, or the Soviets in the past, have had any interest in Swedish waters?
Yeah, I mean, the reason, I guess, today that people are believing that they might be interested in coming in, according to the security and defence experts in the Swedish press this morning at least, They're saying that, well, it's potentially because Sweden is getting a little bit closer to NATO. There's a new government who's expressed, and Sweden in the past few years have been getting closer and closer in a cooperation with NATO. And this is a way of the Russians sort of flexing their muscles to say that if you do join NATO, you know, we're going to be ramping up our activities in the area, you know, because we're sort of more concerned about you, if you like.
Colin, thanks for speaking to us. That's Colin O'Callaghan, a journalist based in Sweden. Brian Finn is back with more business news.
Gavin, thank you. IBM has said it will make a major business announcement today. It's expected that the IT company multinational will announce that it's to offload its loss-making microchip-making business. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that IBM will pay Global Foundries about $1.5 billion to take the chip operations off its hands. Now, there was a 40% increase in construction project commencements in the first 8 months of this year compared to the same time last year. That's according to the group Linked to Plans. Planning applications were up by 12%. Danny O'Shea is managing director of Linked to Plans. And Danny, you compile this data using real-time planning and project information from the local authorities. Now, I've given the percentages, which sound quite good, but in numerical terms, what are we looking at?
Yes, good morning, Brian. This latest edition, which is volume 16 of the National Housing Construction Index, it looks at the housing construction activity for the first 8 months and compares it with the first 8 months of last year, but also gives comparable figures going back to 2011. And you're correct. Well, we look at two metrics in this. One is planning applications, which are the medium to long-term sentiment in the market, and the other are commencements, which is, you know, the here and now of what's actually happening. And at Linked to Plans, we've been doing this for the last 4 or 5 years. So although these are percentages coming off a lower base, these are the first time, you know, we have seen positives on both of them on, you know, three consecutive occasions. So as you say, you've got 12% increase in planning applications. So that upward trend that started at the beginning of the year shows no sign of slowing down. And, you know, it's evidence, we would say, of a degree of confidence returning to the construction sector.
Now, the bulk of the increase, however, was loaded towards the first 4 months of the year, if you like. Was there a particular reason behind that?
Yeah, again, there's the applications, which, as I say, are the medium to long-term sentiment, which are up, and, you know, Dublin is leading the charge there, being up 35%, there are 18 counties that are up on that one. But with commencements, earlier in the year, the entire country was up, and there was a particular distortion there, which we identified at the time, which was a rush to get projects lodged before the March, the first deadline, where the new billing regulations came into play. Now, this had the effect of front-loading the year, so that 70% of all commencements were lodged in the first quarter. But even if you add the subsequent 5 months together, we're still up year on year, and 40% is reasonably positive on that. So maybe this was, you know, an unintended stimulus by the regulators that kicked this on.
So stripping out that factor, do you believe we're seeing a sustainable return to construction activity, particularly in parts of the east and around the Dublin area?
Yeah, I mean, the projects we look at fall into three categories. Well, one would be the residential developments, you know, which are housing estates or apartment blocks, for instance. The other one would be the one-off houses, the self-builds. And then you have your regular domestic extensions. Yeah, and the reasonably large ones, because they're the ones that we only look at the ones that require planning permission. So again, since Linked to Plans was doing this since 2011, at the time residential developments in 2011 made up just 1.6% of the total amount of projects commenced. But today that's jumped up to 6%. So we're seeing the kickoff of those larger type projects are coming in. So I would say that, you know, this is the predicted upturn that is required to make the shortfall that we know about in the market.
And a fall off in three counties, perhaps not surprising: Roscommon, Leitrim and Longford. But we'll leave it there. Danny O'Shea of Linked to Plans, thank you very much indeed. But finally, on the currencies this morning, the euro trading at around $1.27.5 and just above 79 pence sterling.
5 minutes to 8 o'clock, Owen Sherlock joins us from Met Aaron.
Thank you and a very good morning. Well, rain is clearing the southeast coast, but showers and drizzle will continue to affect parts of the south and west this morning. And it's going to remain cloudy today, with further showers once again mainly in western areas. Later this evening, the showers will merge to give a spell of heavy rain along the west coast, and southwesterly winds will strengthen. Highs today of 13 to 16 degrees. A spell of wet and very windy weather will develop early tonight, at first in the west of the country, Some heavy falls of rain are likely, with strong and gusty southwesterly winds, which will reach gale force along exposed coasts and on higher ground. The rain will quickly cross the country, and as it does so, winds will veer west to northwest, but will remain strong and gusty. Lows tonight of 7 to 9 degrees. The rain will slowly clear away on Tuesday morning, but it's going to remain blustery with showers setting in. The showers will begin, though, to ease off during the afternoon, with brighter spells developing. Northwesterly winds will remain fresh to strong, or even gale force along coasts, and it's only going to be later in the afternoon before those winds start to slowly ease off. Highs tomorrow of 12 to 14 degrees, but feeling cold in the wind. Tuesday night's going to be largely dry as the last of the showers clear away, lows of 6 to 9 degrees. And now the outlook. On Wednesday, a band of rain is going to affect parts of Ulster and Connacht and northern parts of Leinster. Further south, it's going to be drier. A mix of cloudy and bright spells with moderate southerly winds. Highs of 10 to 13 degrees. The showers will, though, continue overnight on Wednesday and will mainly affect the western half of the country. Milder day on Thursday, but cloudy with outbreaks of rain as fronts cross the country. Highs of 12 to 16 degrees. And temperatures look like taking a dip on Friday with further spells of rain. We can expect highs on Friday of 10 to 13 degrees. So a quick recap for today. Showers today mainly in western parts, however later this evening it's going to become wet and very windy as heavy rain moves east across the country. Southwesterly winds will be strong and gusty and will reach gale force along coasts. Highs today of 13 to 16 degrees. And that's the forecast. A very good morning.